Tina, thank you very much indeed. I'm Gordon Stewart, and welcome. This is I'm a member of the church congregation here, and welcome to our ecologically friendly church halls. I don't know if you realised that they were very specially designed. And there is an award. The Diocese Advisory Committee has given as an award just in June for this. This is called the Barnabas Building. They've given us that, given it for the design and for the its ecological credentials. But why am I chairing this session? Well, I'm going to start by asking you a question. It's relevant to pretty well everyone in this room here. I used to be an obstetrician, and when I was a much younger man, I came across a problem I couldn't solve in my head, and that was, why did pregnancy occur at all? I had believed in the birds and the bees, but this must have been different. And it was, because the reason for that was the baby inside the womb, the fetus, shares genes from the father and the mother. And if you transplanted a kidney to a woman that had shared the same genes as the fetus did, it would be rejected. So why is the fetus not rejected? Now, it never occurred to you that's the case, but once it came into my head, I spent the rest of my research life, working as a doctor at research life, trying to work with a team to try to solve that problem. And when I got to Oxford, I teamed up with a doctor called Chris Redman, and we set up an immunological laboratory to try to elucidate that problem and others. And we got a young budding scientist to come and work in the department. And that was Chris. Here. So when I moved to take up the chair here in Bristol, I asked Chris if he would join me, and he and Bobby came through to Bristol, and we worked together in St. Michael's Hospital, Bristol Maternity Hospital it was then, in the lab there. And then he deserted me, called to for ordination. I'm not serious about deserting me, by the way, but he called to ordination. He actually led the youth group in this church for some time, so he attended this church. And I might tell a very brief story at the very very end of the meeting about that. But here he is, and he's going to say, once we've given him a warm welcome, I want you to, he will tell you a little bit more about himself post what I've said, what happened from ordination onwards, and where he is now. So, Chris, over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gordon. I was a research immunologist, working with Gordon before that with a guy called Alan Williams in Oxford, and we were living at a very interesting time when monoclonal antibodies were just being developed by Sazer Milstein in Cambridge, and we were beginning to define the lymphocyte cell surface and the different populations of lymphocytes and their roles. So it was very interesting, and I was working on graft rejection and went to work with Gordon on the back of that, really. I was a Christian from university and became, in the 90s, vicar of Barton Hill, the Tower Block estate, as you know, near the city centre. I was there for about 10 years. That was very different from being a research scientist, and taught me many things, and I appreciated very much the people there. But at the end of that, I was beginning to sense that there are some big things going on in our society that I'm not addressing as vicar here in Barton Hill. And I'd like to try to do that. So I wrote an MPhil, which was boldly titled Individualism and the Breakdown of Community Life in Western Society. And whenever I say that title to people, they go, yes. You know, I don't know what it is, but people go, yes. And I think I've lived out of that for the last 20 years, in a way, trying to apply faith, but in a creative way, into the society we now are, and now living in. And it was about, I suppose, midway through the 2000s that it became clear to me, I mean, it's a little clear to many others long before this, but to me, about 2005, it became obvious to me that climate change and our relationship with the Earth generally was going to be the issue of the 21st century, that there was nothing bigger, potentially, that ever occurred on the human agenda. And so I thought, well, there's nothing better than to try to do something about this. And I've spent the last 15 years or so as... I'm surprised it's strange to have one climate activist in the audience. Another one. I mean, yes, and others. Good. Thank you. Lovely. Yes. Extinction Rebellion, of course. Fee, isn't it? Yes. There are some of us here. I mean, I just thought we have to try to do something about this. And initially, I began by trying to interest the church in something we called Earth Abbey, which was about getting in touch with the Earth as Christians. Sadly, the church wasn't as interested as I hoped it would be. I hope it might be now, but it wasn't then. We also ran the vicarage at Barton Hill had become vacant, and so we ran a community gardening project in the vicarage as a way of trying to engage the community with the natural world. Things like that. I became one of the founders of the Bristol Pound, the local currency, which was launched to great fanfare in 2012, still goes today, and you're welcome, and it would be great if you would spend your money. The idea being to localise as much of our economy as we could, and to bring people back into a sense of community, of working together to support one another. That was what was behind, what is behind that, the currency. Bobby and I were involved in a community agriculture project called Sims Hill Shared Harvest, which is still going and feeding 120 households off some land off the M32. So there's a team of half a dozen of us started that. And I went on from Bristol Pound to develop something we called Real Economy, which was to source food from local producers. Food that where we knew how it had been grown, and to get that out to people in Bristol with a particular interest in people who lived in challenging areas of the city, to see if we could do something rather different from food banks in the sense of growing food and people working together as you know, like as a community to grow food and eat healthy food. So. Those are some of the sorts of things I've been doing for the last 15 years. It's been great fun. I have to say, though, that looking back on it, it was like at each stage, it felt, this is good, but it's not enough. Go deeper. That's what I felt at every stage in the last 15 years. This is good, but it's not good enough. Go deeper. And what I'm going to say tonight is really an attempt to try to go deeper. And I'm going to talk language and introduce ideas, some of which you won't be familiar with. And I'm just interested in your reactions, so I'll be very interested in the questions. To some extent, I'm trying ideas out. So let's see how we do. I believed when I first heard about climate change that the only issue was to sort out the science, and if we made sure that we did the science well, the world would adjust. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought that, but I certainly thought that at the beginning. I thought that the battle was for the science. I now don't think it is. I think it was based on an illusion that human society is wholly rational. And it isn't. We are not wholly rational. And we have to sort of face that. We might not like that, but we have to face it. So let's take a step back into a place where we're probably comfortable as scientists. And here are a few disciplines. Of course, there are lots of other disciplines, but these will do to illustrate what I need to say. We have going up the screen an increasing complexity of subject matter. We have different disciplines which, if you like, each exist in a world of their own, but which are built on and consistent with the one below it, all those below it. Science is built in such a way, scientific knowledge is built in such a way, things that in one situation, like chemistry, a nucleic acid might become, in biochemistry, a medium of information. So it can emerge, new properties emerge as you go up the hierarchy. You're familiar with these sorts of things. And of course, science is based on repeatable experiments done well, peer review. And if science is done well, we've shown that it presents a very robust theory of knowledge for the things it can study. But the issue is that a lot of what we deal with as human beings can't be studied by science. So if we go up that hierarchy, we get to ecology, which is, you know, for me, in my head at the moment, the queen of the sciences. It's how we are trying to understand how it all works together. But once the object of investigation is an animal with a degree of self-consciousness and freedom of will, then we need a wholly different method to come to knowledge. That's because we can't know what's going on in someone else's brain. I don't know what you're thinking, and I'm giving you a few insights into what I'm thinking. But in human life, we really don't know what's going on in other people's minds. We have to imagine. And we have a whole set of disciplines, which we call the arts, all of which have as the basis for their theory of knowledge, narrative. People use narrative in different ways. So I'm going to say I'm defining narrative as an attempt at knowledge which includes having to imagine why other people or other social animals are doing what they're doing. You don't know, but you imagine what they're doing. There's a hidden elephant in there that was in Malawi last November. That elephant is a self-conscious animal with freedom of will. And we don't really understand what they're thinking, we guess. And we try to understand what they're doing. So the other thing, so that's one problem we've got. The other problem we've got is that we're social animals and we depend on the life of a group. We evolve not just as individuals based on our individual adaptiveness, but we are dependent on the group or groups that we are a part of. And you've seen that illustrated recently, if you're a David Attenborough fan, on his Dynasties program, you know, where the painted wolves or the chimpanzees or whatever are working together as a group, and the individual members of that group are dependent on the wider group for their survival often, certainly for their success. Now, we are that sort of animal. We depend on group life for our success. And it's significant that in the past 100 years or so, human beings have become increasingly individualistic in that part of the world we now call the developed world. Our group life has eroded. And I think this is a grave danger for all sorts of reasons that perhaps we'll come to. So these two things, the need to work with narrative and the need to be negotiate our life as groups, means that much of our human life is mysterious. Far from being wholly rational, it's actually a bit of a mystery. And there are two fundamental questions that I think are worth asking. How do we sustain the cohesion of large groups? One of the significant things about human beings is that we work in much larger groups than any other animal, any other social animal of the type that I've been talking about. Not ants, because they're a different sort of social animal, but those that are conscious with a degree of free will. We are sustaining much bigger groups. How do we do that? And the other thing is, how do we create narratives that make sense of our society? What is it? How do we do it? We just, you know, in fact, we're bombarded with sensory impressions. We've got a whole host of people we can and do meet. How do we make sense of it all? They're fundamental questions that are really important to us. Our type of groups reach well beyond kinship loyalties. So I'm going to say something surprising here. How do we hold together these massive groups that we are part of? Emil Durkheim, one of the first sociologists of religion, asked this question. And he got to think. He looked at the function of religion. So not what the religion believed, but what difference did it make to their society. And he decided that the deep function of religion itself is social cohesion. It binds people together. It helps people function as groups. And he thought that was definitions, as he called it, of the sacred, were the primary means through which cultures formed and were held together, creating a sense of identity and a holding context for the development of social institutions. Think about our history, just a cursory glance at our history, and you will see how, in the past, all of our institutions, our law, our education, our governance, were all in the hands of religion at one point. And gradually, we've evolved social institutions, which now have a strength and identity of their own, so that the dependence on religion is far less. But it's interesting, isn't it, that it arose that way. What Durkheim says is that actually all cultures in the world have used religion as like a holding context where the religion has given them enough cohesion to then form their institutions and work out their lives. That's why all cultures of the past have been religious in some form or another. I don't know if you've ever asked yourself that question. I used to ask the question, sort of, are they true or are they not? Or how do they compare with what I believe, etc. But I didn't actually ask myself the question, what are they doing? Why are they helpful to that society? And what Durkheim would say, and you know, you're welcome to disagree with him, he studied particularly clan totemism amongst Australian Aborigines, would you believe, where the clan totem is actually a representative of the society of which they're a part. So actually what they're worshipping is their own society. It's their own group. But he thought it might be a general theory of human community. So the second question is, how do we build the narratives that allow us to make sense of the world? Because we have to find a way to filter out and organize the vast amount of sensory and other information we receive. And we do that, again, this might surprise you, we do that through beliefs, values, and commitments. We use beliefs and values and commitments to organize our sense of the world so that we can tell a story. Otherwise, it would just all be terribly confusing. Every narrative discipline that we count as the arts, like history, for example, is dependent on commitments of some sort. Every historian who tells a history uses their own personal commitments to shape their narrative about what happened. And if you are a historian, you'll recognize that's happening. Because that's the only way we can, thank you, we can, I thought you'd given up. That's the only way we can manage the process. It means that no narratives are final. The very essence of good politics is measured by the quality of its public conversation, where stories are brought into tension with one another. Okay, so that's a big step back, telling you a bit where I'm coming from. Let's think about how this might apply to today. I want to try to describe our situation today in three words, which are trust, power, and success. I've used these themes for about 20 years now, and I'm sort of confident of this bit. I think we are seeing an erosion of trust in our society today. Quite seriously, an erosion of trust. And partly it's the individualism that we've come to embrace as normal. In our liberal democracy, we think that individual freedom is the primary thing that you have to pay attention to. And so we just have elected governments and a set of basic freedoms and rights. And that's how we're trying to frame the society. And it was a Guardian leader a few weeks ago that said something to the effect of the writer wasn't clear that liberal democracy had within itself the resources to sustain its life. And that's sort of what I'm saying, that the current way we're conceiving human society doesn't have resources to sustain itself. And what we're seeing is the erosion of trust. So, especially in relation to science, where you see widespread now distrust in the conclusions of science, especially in relation to climate change. Distrust in our political institutions. I mean, we're feeling this in this country enormously, but actually it's across Europe. Distrust in the media with the whole idea of fake news and the internet so that anything can get out there. And it's manifest in terms of a rise in general discontent, the embrace of conspiracy theories and a populist resurgence. The Cambridge Populism Project reported a few weeks ago on a global survey of people who were populists as defined by their by their perception that there were corrupt elites that were exploiting them and that the only way to govern was by the will of the people. So that was the populists. Okay, so you can't trust the people in power, and the only way is a populist vote. That's what. But then they said, so what else do these people believe? So if you've defined populists like that, then look at them and say, what else do they believe? And what you found was they were very strongly favoring other conspiracy theories. So regarding vaccinations, for example, a very high proportion of anti-vaxxers, as they're called, people who distrust vaccination and wouldn't have their child vaccinated. They didn't believe in global heating, as The Guardian now calls it. They were strongly, would sweep away all sorts of reports as fake news from the media. All these are signs of the erosion of trust in a society, and they're based on, often, the confusion between science and narrative. So people are muddled up. They don't know what they can rely on, what they need to debate. So there's a confusion between science and narrative and a pervasive distrust of the dominant stories that uphold authority in general. So that's erosion of trust. I think we also see in our society today unaccountable power. It's a familiar theme to many of us with multinational companies. It was absolutely obvious in the period 1989 to 2000 when the Global Climate Coalition formed of the oil companies and motor trade and people like that, with the explicit aim of confusing climate science. This was an open and deliberate organization designed to confuse the debate. And we've got used to that now, and we notice when it's happening. When the Nigel Lawsons get up now, we notice what's happening. But in those days, they didn't. And the reason America didn't join the Kyoto Protocol was probably because of the Global Climate Coalition sowing doubt. So we could have been onto this agenda decades ago, but for the deliberate obfuscation of those with a vested interest, a commitment to the success of their own industry at the expense of the earth. BP's profits doubled last year to a five-year high as its output of oil and gas soared. They cannot be trusted. They've got some very sophisticated public relations people who will say what they think people want to hear about what they're doing. But the proof of the pudding is in the action. If their output of oil and gas is soaring, that's bad news for the world. Okay, finally, in this outline, we have what I call catastrophic success. And that means that our whole perception of what it means to be successful as a human being is tied to the destruction of the earth at the moment. We've built our society. I said what holds society together. Probably consumerism does at the moment. The idea that individualist consumers. Do you know the story Adam Curtis told in The Century of the Self? It was just at the end of the First World War. And the politicians were saying, so how do we get cohesion together in this society? And Edward Bernays, the cousin of Sigmund Freud, was employed as a consultant. And he thought about this. And there was a big end of war, I think, procession, or some special day. And he was given the problem, why don't women smoke? And he said, get a group of women to walk in the procession and get the media to follow them. And at my signal, get them all to light up a cigarette and say torches of freedom to the media. And that way he identified smoking with women's independence and strength. And of course, women's smoking took off. But what he was doing there was identifying product with something people wanted to feel about themselves. So product with feeling. Adam Curtis also shows adverts of Ford motor cars at the time, where obviously they were black and white, and Henry Ford would come on and say, here it is. That was all the advertising they did. That was as subtle as it was. And you imagine that today with the Land Rover going out over the horizon and the beautiful lady sat next to the man, and they're all, and all the feelings that Edward Bernays did it. He got us to associate product with feeling. And so we've been on this trip of satisfying ourselves with consumerism for 100 years. And the tragedy is that our perception of the world as consumers is completely at odds with our need to live responsibly with the earth. Because, we all know, and you've heard about it. Bobby and I went to Malawi last November. We don't have to say quickly in this context, we don't do a lot of long-haul flights, but this time we did go, and we wanted to go and see what is a seriously impoverished country where people, 80% of people earn less than £1.50 a day, and ask the question, what does progress mean for these people? And someone from a website called Earth Changes set us up a tour of social enterprises in different parts of Malawi where we could go and meet the people and try to understand something. Now, we were only there for 3 weeks, and it's only really tourist observations, so I can't tell you what. But I thought to myself that the reason I wanted to go was because I didn't think that Malawi has to go through a process of what we call development like us. I think there has to be a different path. And I just wanted to explore what that meant. And I was aware as I spoke to people and said, what might progress mean? That everyone went, well, that's the right question. And I still think it's the right question. But what can be done? What can be done for us all, not just for us in the West, but in the poorer countries like Malawi? Where do we turn? I think we need a new kind of relationship with the earth, a different type of relationship with the earth than the one that we've got. The earth does not exist for our use and our abuse, as I see it. It's not there simply as an ecosystem resource, as the economists call it, and as the language the government insists that the economists use. Neither, I have to say, is it there for us to act as stewards towards it, as if it were some vast estate that we managed. I don't think that's good enough. I think we have to recognize two things. The first is that we are participants in the whole earth community, which includes everything that lives. We are participants. We're not standing out there observing it. We're not managing it. We're actually participants. We are creatures. We might be extraordinary creatures. We are extraordinary creatures. But we're very much flesh and blood, and so joined into the life of everything that lives on the earth. And perhaps the challenge then is to live in a certain sort of respectful peace with everything that lives on the earth. That's a different way of perceiving our position from the one that's dominant in our society. These were some guys in Malawi, on Lake Malawi, in a traditional dugout tree, going out to fish for the night. But anyway, I just thought it was a lovely picture. We have a unique relationship with the earth. I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but there is nothing quite like our relationship with the earth. Nothing else in our experience quite like our relationship with the earth. As we understand it, life has arisen through the earth. However, by faith we might conceive that, it's surely true that life has arisen through the earth. And today we're utterly dependent on it. This is why I said ecology is the queen of the sciences, in my view, because it's trying to understand the interactions of everything, all the living systems. So how do we describe that? It's where it all comes from, and it sustains it all. What is our relationship with the earth? Some societies speak of Mother Earth as a metaphor, if you like. You know, a poetic metaphor, Mother Earth, out of which we come. I have some sympathy with that. Pachamama or Tierra Madre, Mother Earth. James Lovelock pointed to the earth as a scientist and said it's a great macro system that has its own life and its own ability to buffer temperatures and sun, etc. And then he called it Gaia, which was the Greek god, which probably was a bit daft, actually, in my view, because it set people up in the wrong direction. But I don't think we need to either personify the earth or to link it to the Greek gods. But I'm going to suggest we do imagine an ancient category, but in a new form. I'm going to suggest that we imagine the earth as sacred, but in a new sense. There, you didn't expect that, did you? No. But the idea of sacred is something that might seem ancient and outdated, based on superstition or magic. That's largely why the Protestant churches, you know, retreated from the whole idea of sacred post-Reformation. Before the Reformation, there were sacred places everywhere. There were all sorts of beliefs and things going on. And Protestant churches said, no, we want to distance ourselves from that superstition, that magic, and all that stuff. And we want something more straightforward and true as we see it to the Bible. But is there a new way? Is there a way for today of thinking about the earth as sacred? In this context, I would take us, I think, to Moses in the desert near Mount Horeb with the sheep. And he sees a burning bush. And he goes over to see what's going on. And he hears this voice, Moses, Moses, take off your shoes, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground. So he takes off his shoes and, well, you know the story. And he is commissioned, called to lead the people out of slavery to their freedom. And that place, Horeb, becomes known as the Mountain of God. And later in the story, we hear that it was the place where the Ten Commandments were given. And so those stories we know and understand, but they were associated with sacred, with a sacred moment and a sacred place. And I would suggest that one way of conceiving the sacred for us today is in terms of inspiring or revealing something. So I don't know if you've had a sacred moment in your life, or there's even a sacred place for you where you feel inspired or something has been revealed. But that, I think, might be at the heart of what we think about sacred as. And I would also say it has a moral aspect. So things that are sacred in any faith are worthy of the deepest respect. We approach them with the utmost care, and they are of ultimate moral value. And I'm asking whether the earth could be that for us. It's worthy of our deepest respect that we approach it with the utmost care and we recognize it to be of ultimate moral value. So of greater worth than anything else we might like to imagine. In terms of inspiring and revealing in relation to the earth, I suppose the obvious place to go is Psalm 19. The heavens are telling the glory of God. The firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, yet their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. So the creation speaks, is itself a revelation. And I would argue this is the heart of what I'm saying as a new sense of sacred. But it's not an old sense of sacred. So it seems to me There is no need for superstition or magic. There is no conflict between this conception of the earth and science. We can treat the earth as sacred without any of those old problems getting in the way. I would say, because I'm interested in this concept being acceptable to people who don't have a particular religious faith. And so I'm saying there is no necessary link with any existing belief system. But a Christian group can still embrace it with absolute integrity to their own story. So a Christian group can say, yes, we will embrace this. But a group of activists can also say, well, we might not have a particular belief system which we adhere to, but we can go with this idea of the earth as sacred, and we can join with you on that. So that's a very delicate tightrope to walk, but it's one I want to try. And the third thing is that if we accept the earth as sacred, then we can engage that understanding, that commitment, with our values concerning how we should behave. It's quite interesting if you think about sacred in a place like Leviticus, that words like pollution come up. That it's offensive to pollute the sacred space. So is it then, if we're to reimagine this for today, that we could conceive a way of life based on principles about clean soil, clean air, clean energy, clean water, clean? That's a religious word, clean. And it is often in opposition to the sacred. And what I'm interested in is that we're already talking this language. That this is happening. You know, if you go to the Soil Association, they'll tell you what clean soil means. And it'll be, you know, not having pesticides in it. It'll be incorporating CO2 into the soil, taking care for the soil and all the organisms in it, etc. We're already onto this agenda as a society. But it seems to me it fits very well with this idea of the earth as sacred. We're also becoming sensitive in a new sense to our food and diet. If you look at the old prescriptions about society's sacred and religion, they've all got dietary laws. Some of them are pretty difficult to fathom as to why you should do this, that, or the other. But they've all got them. And the advantage of what we can do today is that we can engage those, not just as bare commitments. In fact, the dietary laws were often, in the past, simply about holding a community together. It made them different. If you didn't eat pork, it was hard to share a table with others that did. And so dietary laws were often about group cohesion. But today, we can engage them not just as bare commitments, this is what I don't eat, but we can think about the real purpose of why we should eat this food or that food, and why we should care about where it comes from. And I think I've been trying to do that with our community agriculture projects and things like that over the last few years. And I've come to see how it's really good for our well-being to know where our food's coming from, to be actually involved in its production, to have a sense of being a community that's producing food, things like that. So there we are, clean soil, clean air, clean energy, clean water, practices regarding food and diet, that are laden with clear values. I think these things are already happening. I think they're already on everybody's agenda. And in a way, this idea just consolidates it. The idea of the earth as sacred, in this sense, I believe, has the potential to help us reimagine human society at this crucial point in our history. Durkheim taught that the sacred drew people together. And I believe this could draw people together, but on a new basis. Recognizing our relationship with all that lives, that we are partners in a great community of all living things, and we need to find a peace, a shalom, that embraces all things. It could inspire us to reform our institutions, which are currently terribly human-centered, and create a new political and economic agenda. Mircea Eliade, who studied comparative religion, talked about religions as creating worlds. They do this by defining boundaries and building identity. In a way, that's what we need to do, to build a world of resistance to the dominant model, is to build a community across the world of people who share these sorts of values, so that we can reshape our institutions. Mary Douglas, who wrote a seminal work called Purity and Danger on the sacred in Leviticus, said that the identification of the sacred and profane is the primary distinction that human societies make in their development. It comes before anything else. That's what she got from studying Leviticus. She said this is how they originally defined themselves in terms of the sacred and the profane. So as we need to reform our society today, our big global human society, I'm wondering if it would be good to begin again with a consideration of the sacred, and particularly with the earth as sacred, but in this new sense that I've outlined. So I'm going to stop there. There's obviously much more to be said, and what I've done is given you an outline. I hope that'll be enough to provoke some questions. I have two books available tonight. One is called The Dream That Inspired the Bible, which is really about the thread of thinking about shalom in the Bible. Shalom as not just a peace between people, but a peace with the whole creation, which you can trace through the biblical stories. And the second is Rise Up with Wings Like Eagles, and it's a secular-orientated book that incorporates some of the enterprises I've been involved in and some of the thinking we've explored tonight. I'm hoping to write another one now based on the sorts of things I'm saying tonight, and it will be called, I think, Going Deeper Towards a New Kind of Relationship with the Earth. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Very, very thought-provoking. I'm going to invite questions in a minute or two. Could you wait for the microphone to come round to you? Could you say who you are? And if you've got a specific interest, we're happy to hear it. But just two or three words, not a whole paragraph, please. And you're very welcome to answer a question. If you've asked a question, I will be wanting to try to make sure that as many people are allowed to ask questions. So if you've asked one, I will not be coming back to you until such time as other people have actually had a bit of their say. If that's all right, if it isn't all right, tough. Of course, chairman's prerogative. I'm going to ask a one-word question. How?
How do we do that? Yes. Well, my book will contain. But I'll just give you a flavour. One of the things that Durkheim recognized was that the way that groups held together and celebrated their identity was often through festival and rites of passage and things like that. So there's room to develop all sorts of festivals. I love festivals anyway. I think one of the best things about Bristol is there's a festival every weekend through the summer. But I think we could develop a whole set of festivals to do with our relationship with the earth. In Emerson's Green at the moment, we do a... We've just started doing what we've called a Festival of Nature. So we have a Friends of the Park group, we have a community orchard, and on the Festival of Nature Day, we have naturalists come in, and they... I'm booming a bit, Andrew.
Yeah, I think, Gordon, could you move a bit away?
Okay, yeah. We have naturalists come in, and they take us for a walk around, and we listen to the birds, and it is a sort of revelation, really, because you're seeing things you don't normally see, and you're hearing things you don't normally hear, and it's very exciting. And then later in the day, we'll go around the trees, and we happen to have quite a lot of vintage trees in our park, so they're over 200 years old. And this year, we told some of the local stories of life before the estate and the farmland that was there and things, and we had some older people who've told us about the rickyard and how they used to lay the stooks of hay for three bells, which was, of course, three church bells, and, you know, stuff like that. But anyway, and then we did an insect sweep this year, so we were looking at all the insects that are in the long grass, sort of inspiring, revealing sort of stuff. And I just have a feeling that there are all sorts of festivals and rites. I've mentioned diet and food, growing food as communities. We're into campaigns about clean soil, water, energy, etc. Air, yes. And it's really important, isn't it? So a whole gamut of things is possible. I'm very interested in rites of transition. I'm not sure that young people have any real moment when they become adults at the moment. But every other society in history has always had really important rites of transition between being a young person and being acknowledged as an adult. I wonder if we could do something interesting in regard to the earth there. Lots of ideas, yeah. but it's about, for me, it's about this idea of the earth as sacred becoming a focus for all that energy that is there already.
So in one sense, to actually paraphrase another phrase, ecology is the art of the possible. You're actually doing what is possible for you as a community, and you're not actually trying to solve the world's problems from Emerson's Green.
No.
You're actually doing what's possible in Emerson's Green.
Yeah.
And ditto, and if you actually can get the communities to link together.
Yeah, so the last chapter of the book will be called Holy Ground, and it will be about setting up spaces in your own community which are special for you. And if we could have that happening across the world, we would change our consciousness, it seems to me.
Questions? Anyone asking a question? Yes. Firstly, yes.
So, firstly, thank you very much. I think... this idea of the sacred is very important, and I think the way that you've put it across has been something that we can all access. You know, it isn't specifically according to one belief or another. It's very important for this time in history. I feel like it resonates quite a lot with the ideas of creation spirituality, and, you know, there's some very big names that have, you know, introduced me to some of the things you've spoken about. I don't know if I've ever heard somebody speak quite so eloquently about it in my local surroundings, so that's been really wonderful. I suppose my question is, you talked a bit about food, and I remember learning that the word companion comes from that we eat together, we eat bread together, and I really suffer from the other thing you've spoken about quite a lot tonight, being very individualistic, and that applies to my spiritual approach to life. It applies to how I eat. I even find myself eating a different meal to my family quite often, let alone people that live down the road.
Yeah.
And there's so many conflicting ideas about what is right to eat. So it's going to be a journey for us, I think. So, yeah, so
it
I
is.
Mean, I don't know what light you can shed on that, but I mean, there are arguments strongly in favor of a vegan lifestyle, and there are arguments strongly in favor of eating meat if it's bred in the right way. So it's very confusing landscape. I don't know if you can shed some light on
absolutely
that.
It is, and I'm not seeking to unconfuse it at this stage. But I do want, I'll tell you a story. I mean, so as part of Real Economy, we tried to set up what we call community food centres. We had one at Sims Hill. And the way it worked was this, that guys who were in difficult circumstances, perhaps had poor mental health, or perhaps they were struggling just to put food on the table, were invited to come out to the farm, and each week, on the same day each week, and they would do some work in the field together, and then they would cook lunch for themselves outside on a fire pit. And then they would eat lunch together, probably do a bit of work in the afternoon, go away with some food. A very simple model, but actually it was very powerful for the people involved. Because a lot of what we're suffering from, a lot of, you know, low-level mental health difficulty is actually isolation.
Yeah.
And so if you can give people a place they can go to every week where they're involved in meaningful work, they're learning to cook healthy food together, then they'll turn out. And people would turn out in all weathers. You know, in the depths of winter, we'd still have a group, and we'd be eating outside round a fire pit. So that, you know, that encouraged me to think, there's a lot in this.
Firstly, thank you very much. Secondly, as somebody who, being older and not so mobile, is not... Is it on?
It's all right.
It's on. Yes.
Oh, that's better.
I get a lot of stuff from the television, and I want to draw attention to the worldwide social media and the way in which new technology can help us to be drawn together. And I'm wondering whether you have noted, and other people here have noted, television programs, particularly the one about the equator, which showed us South American Indian groups who used the earth and all their what they had in it in exactly the way that you have been showing, talking about.
Thank you. So, I mean, and I think we've also seen with the television that with the story about plastic, how powerful that medium can be in enlivening our consciences about something. I mean, plastic, it's very interesting how plastic caught on. I mean, it's something tangible that we're using every day, and somehow people have really got into this idea that we've got to wean ourselves off plastic. And that came through the television, didn't it?
And I wondered if you found that your friends in Malawi had customs and conventions in their village life which showed the same sort of thing.
Well, I don't think I was long enough there to appreciate their society properly. So I'm sure they do, but I have to say that it's I resist the sort of romantic view about poorer people. What was happening in Malawi, as I could see it, was that people were cooking with wood. And the forest had been destroyed. And you could go for hour upon hour through that country and see a totally degraded landscape, with the women getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to collect wood in order to cook. Now that, for me, is a very serious environmental problem. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how to address it, to be honest. Yes, it is, but we'll have to go into this. Yes. Yeah, I think that's part of the answer.
Can I pick up the point about the sacred? You mentioned that you thought maybe there was no necessary sort of clash or conflict between those who might see the planet as sacred in itself and, say, the Christian worldview or faith that might say the planet, we were given, you know, the planet, but basically, it's people who have been created in the image of God, and it is one of our responsibilities as is to be stewards of the planet. But those who see the planet itself as being, might there not be a clash at times when they put that and the interests of, for example, you've just referred to the poor in Malawi who, you know, they're seeing the sustainability of their lives, their communities, is the key thing for them. At this stage, they have to despoil, to some extent, the planet in order to keep alive. You know, these tensions, do you really see no distinction between what certain communities or faiths hold sacred?
It's very difficult for me to answer that question just off the cuff. I think we'd have to talk for a couple of hours. All I'd say is that I am trying to think about sacred in a new sense, not an old sense. So it's not the superstitious magic place. As I say, it's to do with inspiring and revealing and to do with the moral value of the earth. I do want to counter human-centeredness in Christianity. I do think that the Christian faith is far too human-centered currently. And although the leaders of the church are speaking up about the environment, at grassroots, almost nothing has changed in people's consciousness. And I think that's a problem. So I do want to challenge about that. We've got to plot the value of the earth into our faith.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yes.
Just to quickly follow up on that, I remember about 5 years ago in church commenting about the importance of the environment or the mountains or whatever, and being told that we paid too much attention to creation. We should be putting more time into our spirituality. And I gave up and walked away. Having said that, I'm deeply concerned at the moment, and can do nothing about it, about secondary education in particular. A long time ago, about 18 years ago, I gave up teaching and school inspecting. So things have changed, I think, quite considerably since then, partly due to the right to sue teachers, which was causing immense costs for county councils and, I suppose, now the academies, because somebody had fallen down and scraped their knee. But also, I regret the loss of field trips, which I was passionate about. And we went out for long weekends to save school time. We went out for a week during school time. We had understanding head teachers who knew that if you were doing geography, you actually needed to see it. Scientists have their labs, geographers' labs are out there.
Could you keep it short and come to a question?
Okay, and nowadays, children are not taken out in that way. They no longer have the experience of silence, of majesty, of creation.
Yes.
They no longer have often time in this country. If they go on field trips, they tend to be abroad, which really is not appropriate, I think, at that
age. Thank you. Yes, I mean, I share that frustration as someone who tried to, we tried to do an educational project out from Sims Hill towards schools. We found it very difficult to recruit schools because they're tied up with so many rules today about what they can and can't do. But the good news is quite a lot of young people are trained as forest school teachers now. That's a very interesting thing. They've off their own bat, they've trained themselves or been trained to help children understand the natural world. Or another encouraging thing is a lady called Mary Colwell, who's a Roman Catholic, and she wants to reintroduce nature study into schools. I mean, these things could happen. So, and if you couple that with a transition type, Duke of Edinburgh type thing, but actually orientated towards our relationship with the earth as a transitional thing for young people, I think that might be very interesting as well.
And the Scout movement and the Guide movement do this, as they do that.
Well, our local Cubs are really interesting. Yeah, they've just built a bug hotel in our park and things like that, which is attracting local interest. Yeah. And you've got one out there, haven't you? Yeah, great.
Yes, just going to continue on what you were commenting about Africa, about deforestation for cooking. Yeah. And outside towns, you get mountains of rubbish just piled up. I was in Ghana. The people in the market insisted on putting everything you bought in a plastic bag for whatever reason. I think it was to show you hadn't stolen it or something. There are massive issues there.
But actually, surprisingly, in Rwanda, if you attempt to take a plastic bag into the country, you will be stopped. And they have some very strict rules about plastic in Rwanda, I understand. So it's not all bad news. It can get better.
Question here.
Taking nothing away from your application to natural sciences, my concern is, how does this apply to a group of Christians working in a car factory?
I don't think it does apply to a group of Christians working in a car factory. I'm not trying to solve all the world's problems in one swoop here. You know, I'm not addressing all our issues. So I don't think I can answer that, because I just fluff.
Are you not at risk of elevating the natural sciences and leaving us with the mechanical sciences?
Well, all right. What I will say is that I came here in a Nissan Leaf. I have solar panels on my roof. I have a Powerwall 2 battery in my house. I'm not using any electricity. I love technology. And I see technological innovation as part of the answer. But that doesn't excuse us from changing our perspective towards the earth, if you see what I mean. So the oil companies currently are saying, we can do carbon capture and storage, and we'll go on taking the... And then if we say yes, they'll go on taking the oil out of the ground. Firstly, I don't believe them with their technology. Secondly, I'm very suspicious about the big geoengineering projects. I think that could really mess the earth up. I said there about being about the earth as sacred, I said we approach it with the utmost care. And it seems to me that's exactly what the big geoengineering projects aren't doing. So that's the sort of answer. That's the approach I'd make to your question.
I'm afraid now the elephant's out of its corner. How are poor people going to be doing this?
Okay, well that's because I've just mentioned.
I have arguments with vegans all the time about how we're actually going to care for our poor people and the people that we love. And
okay, no, it's a really good question, and it's one that we tried to do this thing called real economy, and we did want to try to get the best food to people in the most challenging circumstances. And the way we came up with doing that was by trying to encourage communities of people growing food. And it's come to me, people are talking about basic income these days. The Greens are talking about basic income. You know, the most basic income of all is the oldest sort of income, which is to give some people the ability to work some land, to grow some food. That if you have a patch of land where you can grow your food, you have some basic income. But it's not financial income. And you also have the ability to work together with others and so form a community of solidarity. Now, we've been playing with that. It's only playing with it. But I do think it has potential. I think that, I mean, I was 10 years in Barton Hill. And I've tried to do this sort of project. So I think I have felt and tried to address it. I agree that when I start talking about Nissan Leafs and Powerwall 2s and things, that's not accessible to ordinary people. But if we're talking about deforestation in Malawi, you said solar panels. I think one could conceive of some investment that, at a village level, created a solar array and some batteries, and some electric cooking, using Ramoscas and things. Well, so there might be different solutions, but I think if we're creative about it as human beings, and we recognise it's a problem, as you do, then I think we can address it. But it's not. We don't have to say we can't do that because they're poor.
That's the important thing. We don't say what you. There are lots of reasons for not doing things.
Yeah.
And we keep on coming up with them.
Yeah.
If we're not very careful, I do that. I must confess.
Yeah.
And some. Yes. Last question.
My question is sort of was going to be was just been asked, but I'll add to that. Most of the issues you've talked about, like deforestation and whatever, and carbon capture. I mean, it is available. It's all available. You know, the technology is available. It's only really the economics making it affordable for people. But my real final comment really is that it's very difficult if you're struggling to put food on the table for your family who are all hungry and you're hungry yourself to actually then consider the earth as a sacred place. And for most of us in this room, that doesn't necessarily apply. And it's very difficult to be not to be selfish. That's really, I mean, there's not necessarily any answer, but it's
I think what you're saying is sort of probably true in this sort of society, which is a very degraded society. But if you went to some of the poorer nations in the world, they might actually accept this idea much more readily. There's something about our society that's pretty sick, actually. Our poorest communities are really struggling there. Family life's often broken down. There's low-level mental health difficulties. Health difficulties are extraordinary. So in different parts of Bristol, people are dying 10 years younger than in an area like Redland. So in Southmead, they'll be dying 10 years younger than people in Redland. Now, that's enormous and a scandal. And I agree with you, but it's not an excuse not to engage with this stuff. The solution will be found together. It'll be found working together, appreciating one another, building community life that's in association with the earth. And I've seen enough to think that that sort of thing can be done.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. I'm going to just say thank you to Chris. No, I'm not. I'm going to ask Andrew to say something just now about the Christians and Science, and then I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to hand you over to...
Thanks, Gordon. I just wanted to say that Christians in Science is planning forwards, and one of the things we're looking at trying to do is to provide resources to help local churches to get particularly their young people, but all members of the congregation, to explore just their graveyard and get and all this sort of thing, to get to grips with nature. Things like Messy Church you may have heard of. You can do those sort of things. So we're looking, along with the Faraday Institute, at developing those sort of resources. It'll take time, it'll take money, but I think we've got to engage the churches at a level that they are really not engaging, which I think you were really saying, Chris.
So yeah,
we're trying our little bit.
Yeah, I think graveyards is a bit weak.
Well, no, graveyards is a start. I mean, no, but you know, where's local? You've got to start somewhere.
I mean, you know, liturgy. So every week in quite a lot of churches, people will say that we've sinned against you, meaning God, against our neighbour. Now, how about we add the phrase, and against the whole creation? To that confession each week, that would change the consciousness of the church. I think that could be done.
Yeah, we'll try. Yeah? I was going practical.
Well, that's practical.
I can have asked about a bit of an unfair question to begin with when I asked how, because, of course, we far too often... expect our speakers to talk and then give us all the answers so we can go home with the answers. That's just not the way it works ever.
No.
And I want to thank Chris for actually coming up with things that we will go away with, and he's given us some things we can handle. We actually can progress on, each of us, and in our communities. And that's important. I told you that Chris came through with me from Oxford. And he came to this church, and he was actually the leader of the youth in here.
Well, one of, we're part of a team, actually.
Sorry.
Bobby was
Bobby, Bobby, I beg your pardon,
yeah,
Bobby.
And
sorry.
Peter Gifford and lots
yeah,
of Bob, us.
Yeah, I know, but he was, yes, one. But the reason for mentioning is that there was a young man in that group who actually, Chris had talked about his research, and Chris brought him into my lab. We learned about immunology. That man, a young man, is now my son-in-law. and he got a PhD in immunology. He was going to work with the man who was your supervisor, but he very inconveniently died before Tom could go and work with him, so he went to UCL. He then had a daughter who's now at Oxford in her second year in medicine, and she's in the same lab as you were in Oxford,
really?
Doing research on the lymphocytes that you were doing.
Yeah.
So he cast his bread on the waters there, and it's actually born fruit, and he's cast his bread upon the waters here. So it's up to you, to make it bear fruit, and B, to say thank you.
So, as this is the very last talk in the Fragile Planet series, I just thought I'd take the opportunity to introduce Fee. Do you want to stand up? Richard, do you want to stand up? Could all those who've been involved with any kind of activism stand up? Right. Okay, so what I've managed to do, these are people who I do stuff in Bristol. I don't know if I'd call myself an actual activist, but I campaign for local rail. I'm campaigning for clean air. We just did clean air day yesterday. I love it. I don't stay in the church. I go out. And I've been in groups where we don't talk about God at all. We talk about clean air. We talk about the trains. We talk about the buses. And I just love them to bits. They're my family. And I put out an email last week explaining us as a group, saying, please, please come to us. We will try and come to you, but we're, you know, sadly in this silo called the church. And we've really got to break this down. We've got to break down the walls, invite people in, because to show that we want to learn from each other, we want to work with each other. There's no point us going, oh, let's set up a Christians and Science environmental group. That will not be a good idea. I mean, I certainly do a lot of politically. I would say there's a political problem with our mayor right now, and that he's concerned very much on the right, but that, you know, let's not go into that. I just want to introduce these lovely people, and
thank you. I was very touched by your email in which you spoke about us joining you and wanting Christians to come out of their bubble, their Christian bubble, because there is so much going on out there, really exciting stuff, new stuff. And I'd love to invite you all to come to an Extinction Rebellion meeting. We meet every Wednesday evening in Bristol, and Tuesdays and Thursdays. There are more than one group, but the central group meets on a Wednesday. And it occurred to me that what we're actually doing is forming a kind of church. We share a meal to begin with, always a vegan meal, and we're building community. And one of my jobs is to induct new people. And in that, I tell them about the demands of Extinction Rebellion, which is that our government actually take direct action on climate change, and like yesterday. But the other thing we talk about is our principles. And our principles are all about respect, respecting one another, something called mitigating for power, where we actually take direct action to bring forth the weaker members of the community and maybe close down the more vociferous ones so that, that there is more equality of sharing. There are so many things that they are doing in the Extinction Rebellion community. They call it creating a regenerative culture. And basically, it's about love. The overlap between you and the church and what the mainly young people are doing is phenomenal. And I would really recommend you to come and sample it, as I would want them to come and sample what you have to offer.
Well, thank you very much indeed.
So we'll have to close the meeting there, sadly, but please go and see Fee. Richard's over there as well. There's something else I want to recommend, which is the Bristol Green Capital Partnership, and that's more mostly to do with business. But we have green mingles every Thursday evening, so that's down at the kitchen in Silver Street. There's all sorts of things going on. We have no need to start reinventing the wheel here. So thank you so much for coming. The other thing I want to say is that don't forget donations, but also take lots and lots and lots of leaflets. I have printed 3,000 leaflets, okay? Now, I know this isn't great for the planet, but actually, printed material is now known to have the highest impact, far higher than social media. People will take a piece of paper, they will look at it, it will be on their table, it will remind them, okay? And, you know, obviously we're going to recycle it, you're going to recycle it. I don't want to have anything left. I've printed 3,000 this time. So let's get the, you know, get people to Christians and Science, let us go out. And the people who've ticked on that, I'm going to send you an email with as many links as I can possibly think, because you don't have to be an activist. You could, you know, you could do whatever you, there's something for everyone. So please, and then I'm gonna take your challenge up for you. I felt very scared when you mentioned Extinction Rebellion, and very even scarier when I said, come to our talk. I said, well, you come to ours. So I'm gonna take you up on that. I'm gonna turn up, all right? And I hope other people will as well. So thank you very much for coming. Thank you again to Chris. I just want to say it was such a special talk. I mean, we have some pretty good speakers, but I don't know, it's just something so utterly sacred already, and I you know, very convincing. And but it really, I mean, today, we had Clean Air Day yesterday, we were out in Castle Park giving gifts to people who'd come in car free. But today, you know what, I went down to the floating harbour, I worked on my boat, and the wood, I thought Jesus was a carpenter. And, you know, Jesus, he was in connection with, you know, he fished, he let's reconnect with this amazing world God's done for us. And we are part of it, we need it. We can't just walk away and sit on plastic, it's ridiculous. Thank you very much.